Antibiotic resistance is a growing concern, with antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria popping up all over the world, even here in Iowa. But what can be done about it? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll speak with several researchers at the University of Iowa who are studying how infections spread in hospitals and how new technology is coming to the rescue. Before that, how antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria can now be found in several wildlife species in the state and the danger that presents. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Antibiotic resistance is a growing concern, with antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria popping up all over the world, even here in Iowa. Previously, a specific drug-resistant bacteria strain called methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA, had been found in some of Iowa's retail pork products. But now, it can also be found in several wildlife species in the state. University of Iowa researchers recently found drug-resistant MRSA in two eastern Iowa cottontail rabbits and one migrating bird, the lesser yellowlegs. Tara Smith is co-director of the University of Iowa Center for Emerging Infectious Disease and an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Iowa. My colleague Catherine Perkins spoke with Smith, and she began by asking her what this recent discovery tells us about this increasingly drug-resistant bacteria.
It tells us really that MRSA is everywhere. So we knew previously, of course, this has been a human problem for about 50 years, mostly in the hospitals. And in the last decade, we found it in the community and people that didn't have healthcare contact. We found it in pet animals. We found it in livestock. And so now we've seen that it's moved not only from those animals, but into wildlife as well.
How did you make this discovery in wildlife?
it was actually a project of one of my master's students. In collaboration with the Wildlife Care Center at Iowa State University. So again, we knew that we had found it in other animal species, and we wanted to see kind of how far it was spreading. So they take in animals that have been hit on the road or injured in some way and rehabilitate them. So we asked if they would be willing to collaborate and let us, or really have their staff, swab any animals as they entered the facility and then send us those samples for testing.
So out of how many animals did you find these three that tested positive for MRSA?
Good question. I don't have that on me. it was about 100 animals, I think, that we had ended up testing.
I guess the probably the better question would be, do we know how widespread this is based on just those three animals?
Yeah, no. I mean, this was completely a convenient sample. Obviously, we didn't have any methods to go out and more systematically test wildlife, look at all rabbits in one area or all deer or something like that. So it was definitely, just the animals that happened to be injured and come into this. So we really don't know how widespread this is. And of course, it was also animals, kind of just in the Ames area. So we don't know if this crosses Iowa or is, statewide, nationwide. We don't know.
But you were obviously looking for this. What led you to want to look for this?
Uh-huh. Well, just because we had seen it in so many other places. And I'm a big wildlife fan. I have a daughter that, loves bunnies especially and everything else, and tries to rescue like baby birds in our yard. And we know that they carry a lot of other potential pathogens, but hadn't really looked for MRSA previously.
So do we know how the infection jumped to this species?
Mm-hmm. We don't. And that's one of the limitations of the study also, is that for the MRSA strains that we found, the one in the migratory bird is very closely related to those that we see in the hospital. It was resistant to a lot of antibiotics besides just methicillin. The ones we saw in the rabbits were very similar to those that we see kind of in the community. So the ones that's emerged in the past about 15 years and is associated with like wrestling and football and things like that. So it's probably, some kind of, ultimately a human reservoir that they picked this up from. But, whether it was via garbage, or there was a recent study finding MRSA in sewage, so, human waste, or some kind of other environmental reservoir, we just don't know.
So I guess the next question would be, do we need to do anything about this?
Mm-hmm. For the average person, no. I mean, you know, most people aren't out handling wildlife species actively. And, you know, it's something that probably, you know, does not jump species frequently. And wildlife are probably as much at risk from us as we are from them. So it's something that, you know, more for people who are hunters or, you know, spend a lot of time outdoors or something like that and come across wildlife, you know, just something for them to think about to, you know, probably many of them already, you know, wash up and things after touching animals and use proper protection equipment and when they're butchering animals or something like that. So, you know, just one more thing for them to think about.
Are there past examples of some sort of a bacterial infection like this jumping from species to species?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's actually pretty common. You think about something like tuberculosis, actually, where especially before the pasteurization of milk, humans could get bovine tuberculosis from drinking milk and from being in contact with cattle. Anthrax is actually, you know, a bacterium that pops up in animals more common than humans, and we get it from them. So there's a lot of things that can jump around from species to species pretty easily.
And do we know how transmissible this MRSA strain or these MRSA strains are in terms of to people?
We don't. For the community-associated strains, the ones that were in the rabbits, they seem to spread pretty easily between humans because those were really only first seen about 15 years ago, and now they're all over the place. The hospital ones tend to be more deadly and more antibiotic resistant, but they seem to have a little of a limited capability for transmission, at least compared to some of the other strains.
Okay. So are there long-term implications for us in terms of knowing that these are spreading all over the place? I mean, is this something we need to be concerned about?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're mostly concerned about it just, you know, from the potential for these to be evolving out in places where we're not looking for them. So, you know, we don't typically think of wildlife as a reservoir for these type of things, but it's possible. And, you know, they may be developing their own strains that could later cross into humans. So it's just nothing to be concerned about, but, you know, something especially for us biologists to kind of take a look at.
You were part of a group of researchers that earlier this year released results that MRSA was found in retail pork products in the United States. Mm-hmm. Have there been any new developments on that particular strain or those findings?
Mm-hmm. We have an ongoing study that's actually ending in about another 2 months here, where we've been looking at MRSA in food and meat products for almost a year now. So we don't have any of that data kind of analyzed yet. It's been a big project, and we're still kind of getting in some of the data. But hopefully by next summer, we'll have those results analyzed and can say a little bit more about that.
Okay. So the bottom line on this in terms of finding this in wildlife, you know, is that people shouldn't necessarily get panicked, but
absolutely
researchers need to kind of keep an eye on it, right?
Right, right. And if you're out working with wildlife, just be careful, wash your hands, not only for this bacterium, but for lots of others that they can carry.
And one more question. I'm always interested about with people who study these kinds of things. How do you prevent from being in a constant state of panic?
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we're very careful in the lab. We wear lab coats. We wear gloves. We wash our hands very, very frequently and try to keep everything, you know, from the lab in the lab and not going outside of it. So, I mean, we also know that, you know, the risk from these for the average person is generally low. So, you know, we try not to panic and realize that a lot of people are carrying these and never get sick from them. So,
Tara, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
That was my colleague Catherine Perkins speaking with Tara Smith, the co-director of the University of Iowa Center for Emerging Infectious Disease and associate professor of epidemiology, talking about the drug-resistant bacteria MRSA in Iowa's wildlife. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now let's continue talking about infections, but talk about infections in humans and change the setting from wildlife areas to hospitals to talk about MRSA and other bacterial infections in Iowa's hospitals. Joining me first of all to do that is Maren Schweitzer. She is a PhD in epidemiology and has a PhD in epidemiology and is an assistant professor at the University of Iowa Department of Internal Medicine in our Iowa City studio. Maren, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
In a recent study, you looked at curtains in hospitals. These are sort of dividers. We know them used all around hospitals. They're a real hygiene challenge you found out in hospitals. Why did you look at curtains and what did you find?
So we thought that hospital privacy curtains were important to look at because they're in every patient room and people touch them before, during, and after patient care. And not only do the doctors and nurses touch them, but patients touch them, their visitors touch the curtains. And so they're highly touched, but they're not cleaned as often as you would think because it's not easy to clean them. Think about the curtains at your house. You have to take them down, put them in the washing machine, clean them, hang them back up.
Mm-hmm. And also I think we think because they're a vertical surface that they don't collect things. Things might just kind of skid down and fall off. We think they're clean. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Well, and so we did two studies, and the first study was just to see if there was a problem. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we tested them to really see, is there bacteria there or does it fall off? Mm-hmm. So for that study, we actually hung up 30 freshly cleaned curtains in the patient rooms, and we tested them over 3 weeks. And we actually found that 92% of the curtains were contaminated within 1 week with potentially harmful bacteria like MRSA. So we were a little surprised by the fact that these were contaminated really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Had such a curtain study been done before?
So there were a few that had been done that just tested curtains once. So they would just walk into a patient room, the curtain had been hanging up for a while, mm-hmm. and they just swabbed them, and they found similar results. But we actually did it over time. So we started with clean curtains, and we found that some of the curtains had the same bacteria over and over again, while other curtains lost one type of bacteria and then ended up picking up another kind.
Okay. So if we were to visualize bacteria on curtains, I'm thinking of, you know, a typical part of the curtain, the front end of the curtain, if I can say that, where you would pull at about, you know, chest height.
Right.
You would pull it and make a fingerprint or something, a handprint on it. Does a bacteria kind of stay in that or does it spread on the curtain? Did you study, look at that?
Yeah, we looked at the high touch areas of the curtain is what we called it. And what we actually did was we had a shorter research assistant grab the curtain where she usually would pull it. We had a taller physician grab the curtain where he would usually pull it. And we measured it around a meter around that area to really make sure we were getting the highest touched part. So we didn't really swab the parts that no one is going to touch.
Okay. So go on. What else did you find?
Yeah. So then we did a second study. And this was looking at experimental curtains. And so these looked exactly like our standard curtains, but they had a metal alloy incorporated into the fibers. And so we hung up, we randomized intensive care unit rooms to receive either these clean standard curtains or the experimental curtains to see if the bacteria wouldn't survive as well on the metallic curtains. And we actually found over 4 weeks that unfortunately both types of curtains ended up becoming contaminated with bacteria in that four-week time period. But just like the first study, our standard curtains became contaminated at an average of about 2 days, whereas the experimental curtains became contaminated at an average of 2 weeks. Mm. So these curtains do need to be studied more, maybe improved, but at least, you know, there's a chance that hospitals could keep up with this. And if they wash the curtains every 2 weeks, maybe the curtains would be a lot cleaner.
Mm-hmm. Let's back up a little bit and have you talk about bacteria and infections, what this has to do with complications in hospitals and why it would be so important to keep bacteria from growing on curtains or other surfaces in hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of bacteria are perfectly fine for people like you and me where we carry it in our nose or on our skin. But it's when someone has a surgery and that bacteria gets in their surgical site, or if someone has a compromised immune system and they're exposed to the bacteria, that's when it can cause really severe infections like pneumonia and bloodstream infections.
Okay. Maren Schweitzer is an epidemiologist, assistant professor in the University of Iowa Department of Internal Medicine, talking the rest of this program about hygiene in hospitals, the consequences of poor hospital hygiene, and how new technology is improving hospital hygiene. Joining us to help do that is Dr. Philip Palgreen. He is the director of infectious disease, the Infectious Disease Society of America's Emerging Infections Network, and a University of Iowa associate professor. Dr. Palgreen, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And also joining us, Jason Fries. Jason is a University of Iowa PhD graduate student in computer science. Jason, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thank you as well.
So if we could, Dr. Palgreen and Jason Fries, pick up with Maren there presenting. One of the problems, a big problem in hospitals, is to reduce bacterial infections, to reduce the bacteria that's not wanted in certain areas. So what can we do? We want to talk about hand washing. We want about talk about changing people's behavior. Tell us, Dr. Paul Green.
You know, one of the most important interventions that we can do is increased hand hygiene compliance among healthcare workers. And we know that from study after study, but yet study after study also shows that healthcare worker rates of healthcare worker hand hygiene remain really unacceptably low, averaging 50%, and in some cases much less. And I think one of the big questions is why. There are effective interventions that have been done, but they take a lot of effort, and sometimes they're not sustainable. But one of the things that seems to work is feeding back rates in order to change behavior.
Okay, so feeding back rates of, let's say, in a hospital, how many times should a person wash his or her hands? I suppose that depends on their function in the hospital.
Absolutely. In fact, I mean, that's one of the things that our group, the Computational Epidemiology Group, is interested in kind of understanding. How many opportunities are there in a day? Mm-hmm. And so little is known. I mean, there are general rules and principles to follow, you know, before and after touching a patient, before doing a sterile procedure, after touching the environment that might be contaminated, whether it's a curtain. But you know, very little is known about how many of these opportunities occur during the day. And the little work we've done shows that there are a huge number, and it might hint to why compliance is not always perfect, because there are literally hundreds and hundreds of opportunities probably throughout the course of the day in some of the busiest healthcare workers that are most connected.
This reminds me of something. Tell me if it's akin to this or not. We know that lower speed limits reduce the number of accidents in the cities on our highways and things like that, and we will see the sheriff or the police department put up one of those real-time radars that says how fast we're going. You're going 25. No, you're going 28. No, you're going 32 in a 25 zone. So we know in this case what practices reduce bacterial infections, the chances of that. Is that what you're saying, doctor? We just need people to comply and know when they're doing it right and when they're not.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. Traffic safety comes up a lot in hospitals, both airline safety and traffic safety, and people talk about feeding back rates as with these speed indicators, and people also talk about seatbelt use, trying to get that sort of habit of doing something so that it's not even something you think about, that you do it when you walk in a room, when you walk out of a room.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really kind of great way to think about this. But we've been studying these other problems, traffic problems, probably a lot longer than we have studying behavior within a hospital room or on a hospital unit.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly one of the problems is getting the information to feed back to healthcare workers to improve their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So
and this is what you've been working with, Jason.
Absolutely.
Right? So talk about what you've come up with. What have you been trying out?
We've tried multiple different things. We started out actually, and we're still working on it, but was to develop a system along with a lot of collaborators, Alberto Segre in computer science and Ted Herman in computer science and Geb Thomas in engineering and lots of graduate students. We've been building a system that's reasonably portable, that can help us understand, you know, when there's an opportunity and when someone practices hand hygiene or not. And they're sort of, this is based on something called a sensor moat that we distribute.
A moat.
It's a small, just think of it like a small computer about the size of a thumb drive.
Mm-hmm.
That can fit on a badge, ID badge now. We've got them that small. They're powered by an iPod battery. Very small, and
they're clipped to your garment,
or we've put them in pager casings, mm-hmm. and we can distribute these to healthcare workers and understand how they move throughout the hospital. And if we attach them to hand hygiene dispensers, then we know whether the dispenser's been activated or not.
And so I'm walking around the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, and I have a moat on, and it's going to measure when I wash my hands.
Well, we've only done these in certain units because the equipment's, although it's really quite expensive, and it's good for study and research. But exactly, you'd wear one, and it would know if you went into a patient room, if you left the patient room, and if you practice hand hygiene in or out.
Mm-hmm.
And what's nice is it's very portable. There are some other commercial approaches, that where you have to do a lot of instrumenting and put wires in the walls. And we didn't develop this for commercial purposes necessarily. It was more to understand behavior.
Mm-hmm. Jason Fries, you are a PhD grad student in computer science, and one of your areas of focus is it's computational epidemiology. Tell us, and that's what we're talking about, an
Excellent.
Application of that right now, but tell us how that fits into medicine today?
Sure. Yeah. So the sort of the key idea is that we have a lot of data emerging from all manners of domains. Certainly, we've seen this in most recently in the political election, where we have a lot of data about demographics. Well, if we start thinking about these problems in a more sort of computational way, where you start thinking about how you can build sort of models of people's behavior, people's beliefs, and you can start doing such stuff like simulations, and you can start sort of building probabilities and estimates about what's going to happen. And if you can do that with enough computational power at this point to start making sort of real-time estimates of what's going to happen, and those type of real-time estimates can be then used to guide policy. So in a hospital situation, the amount of data that emerges every day from patient telemetry, and then increasingly what we hope for in our group, sort of behavioral telemetry, if you think of it, of healthcare workers themselves, can all be fed back into this feedback loop of information that will ultimately hopefully improve patient care.
That's a tremendous amount of data. Now, we have the patient telemetry, the patient data that we've been getting more and more of it. How's that patient doing before an operation, during an operation, after an operation? And now you're saying this kind of data measurement is going to be applied to healthcare workers in hospitals increasingly to reduce infections.
That is the goal, yes, right, okay. Most definitely. So and what we've seen is we've seen a lot of things. There's sort of a trend now. Everyone has a number of people in our population have a very large and powerful computer system in their smartphone. So we've seen a sort of trend to this real-time feedback idea. And what you've seen is that you sort of – if you make people aware of their behavior in the moment, you can actually start changing how they behave. You see applications for improving your sort of exercise patterns and so forth. And the hope is that, well, why can't we just take all of this information and slide it right into an aspect of patient care? Healthcare workers should have access to this information. You should be told, oh, maybe you're not keeping your hand hygiene compliant rates as highly as you should. And that nag, because everyone's best intention, of course, is to be as compliant in this context
as
possible.
Wait a minute. So what I'm getting is that we might get sick. You have in your community a couple different hospitals you can choose from. So you could in the future perhaps look up online the hand washing compliancy of the hospital you plan to attend.
That's an interesting you have to think about whether that would be interesting if that were available. But hospitals themselves would certainly want to know their rates and strive towards increasing the compliance. So,
I mean, so Jason did a study where based on an iPhone app that our group made, and Jason built the feedback interface that on a monitor – nurses used this iPhone application called iScrub.
Right.
Okay. iScrub. We are going to take a break. I want to get into iScrub after we come back because this is really an interesting app, and I think it's been around for a couple years.
It has, yeah.
So let's talk about what this app, this hand-washing app called iScrub does when we come back, how perhaps you've tweaked it in the meantime, how it's been used. My guest, Jason Fries, he is a University of Iowa PhD graduate student in computer science. He busies himself with something called computational epidemiology. I'd like to have that on my visiting card, as well as Maren Schweitzer is with us. She's an epidemiologist at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Philip Paulgreen, and he is the director of the Infectious Disease Society of America's Emerging Infections Network and the University of Iowa associate professor. If you have any questions about what we're talking about hygiene in hospitals, bacterial infections, please get in touch with us this next half hour, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of hygiene in hospitals and how high-tech is coming to the rescue after a short break. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we're talking about hygiene in hospitals, specifically the consequences of poor hospital hygiene, how new technology is improving hospital hygiene. Joining me to do that, Maren Schweitzer is an assistant professor at the University of Iowa Department of Internal Medicine. She's an epidemiologist, and Dr. Phil Paulgreen is with us, director of the Infectious Disease Society of America's Emerging Infections Network, also a University of Iowa associate professor, and Jason Fries. He is a graduate student, a PhD student in computer science at the University of Iowa, focusing on computational epidemiology. So finding out what's happening in high-tech terms at the hospitals to reduce bacterial infections is what we are talking about this hour. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I wanted to talk about this interesting app called iScrub, but before that, I wanted to back up and ask whoever wanted to jump in here to give us a little primer, a little idea of bacteria, that we have an idea of where it is in our lives, why in a hospital situation it's particularly dangerous, because we can't say bacteria, that's all bad. Life depends on it, doesn't it, doctor?
Oh, it does. I mean, we can't live without bacteria, and animals reared in sterile environments don't do very well.
Okay,
and,
so where do we find bacteria in this studio right now?
On our skin, in our nose, mm-hmm. And throughout our intestines, and they help us digest food and probably in some cases protect us from acquiring other more pathogenic organisms. But okay. They're critical.
Okay, yeah. Marin, yeah?
Yeah, if you think about probiotics in yogurt as well, I mean, that's bacteria that people are purposely eating just to make sure that you have good bacteria in your stomach. Mm-hmm. So it's not all bacteria. There's some good bacteria as well. And it's usually only when someone is sick, when someone has a cut, that sort of thing, does the bacteria get into places it shouldn't be.
And then it depends on the type of bacteria that is here. Like we find this methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA. That is a particularly deadly bacteria?
Well, I mean, not in all cases. I mean, lots of people are colonized with MRSA and do just fine. Mm-hmm. And it's really what complicates and why this makes it is problematic is it's much harder to treat. And there's some evidence that, you know, maybe it's more pathogenic, but really it's a treatment issue that we don't have antibiotics for those people that do get infected. But throughout the course of the day, we're all – every time we brush our teeth, we're all bacteremic. We have – you could – if you go to the dentist, you can start drawing blood cultures. We could grow some organisms from – I'll be going there later today. And if you started drawing my blood, you would grow some bacteria. But mm-hmm. in most cases, it's taken care of. It's handled. It's these few cases where, especially when people are immunosuppressed or have weak immune systems, that it becomes a problem.
Okay. So we're back in the hospital setting. And Marin, you told us earlier about studying curtains. We find privacy curtains we find in hospitals. They're touched by hands. So we're looking at ways that we can reduce the bacteria on curtains and so reduce them on patients in wounds and things like that. So we here, let's enter the application iScrub.
Yes.
Tell us about iScrub. It came into being a couple years ago. What does it do?
Sure, yeah. So as we've been talking about, hand hygiene is critically important to patient care in hospital settings. So to monitor sort of a hospital's compliance level, they have observers go around on units and measure the rate at which people successfully wash their hands at those points in time that they should be washing their hands. So this is sort of done in previously it's done sort of in a pen and paper type of fashion. You keep notes down, you measure it for internal purposes, and it goes to various managers, but it never is really a loop back both in the real-time feedback to the individuals that were observed or really to anyone else outside of sort of the observer and the perhaps nurse manager of some sort. So our idea was, well, we have, you know, smartphones are pretty pervasive in the world today. So if we thought if we developed an iPad or iPhone iTouch application where people could actually monitor hand hygiene compliance, we could sort of create this all digital loop where the information was then fed back to some sort of system and it's all in a digital format. You can start doing more sort of robust analysis with that data. And then probably most importantly is that you have access to this information in real time. So if a monitor is going around and monitors in the morning and the afternoon, you could pipe these results back to individuals on a computer monitor in the unit, and they could have this sort of behavioral telemetry of their compliance. And we'd anonymize it by basically reporting only compliance by job type, so you know how nurses are doing in washing their hands and how well physicians are. And the idea is that, you know, if people were just made aware both as the healthcare workers themselves and then the patients who come in the unit and sort of are now cognizant of the healthcare workers that they're interacting with, their level of compliance, the hope is that the overall the incentives or pressures to maintain compliance would actually result in an increased hand compliance.
You said anonymous, but wouldn't it be helpful for not only that person to know his or her hand washing compliance, but also the supervisor of that person.
Sure, most definitely.
And so that feedback loop goes to those people as well?
Not at the moment. That is certainly an excellent idea. And we thought about, you know, you could sort of create a secondary private loop where an individual is made aware of their personal compliance, but they're not known as maybe like the bad apple in the group. And so because that could create all kinds of bad sort of, you know, sort of counter incentives in the group to wash your hands. So, you know, a private level where people know how well they're doing, but then an aggregate level so that, you know, it's sort of a little more fair and doesn't single people out.
I wonder how this information. So we've got levels of hand washing, and then we've got what we talked about here, this sort of social network in a hospital where we have thousands of people. In the case of the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, we have thousands of doctors and nurses doing all kinds of things, not to speak of the other medical personnel going around. So we want to study all of those people, how they're interacting, where they're going, how they're using their hands, doctor?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. We know very little about how people move and interact in a hospital, and we don't know really where hands go, what they touch, et cetera. And our group just published a study where we use these kind of sensor motes to understand how people move and flow through the hospital. And what we do is we did this for a couple weeks, and we gather this information about how people move and interact, and then we run simulations where we get this information and we pretend like there's an infection using this information, see how it would spread. And we do this thousands and thousands of times just to do that, to figure out, you know, do the sort of the way people interact, does that affect how infections spread? In other words, if a particular very connected person does not perform hand hygiene, how does that affect the society, meaning the unit, as opposed to someone who's not as connected? And it turns out that it makes a big difference. And so if you have people that are incredibly connected, we use the word peripatetic, but it'd be people that are seeing more patients and other healthcare workers, if they don't practice hand hygiene, the impact is much greater on the potential to spread infections than otherwise.
Join our conversation, hygiene in hospitals and how high tech is helping out. 1-866-780-9100. Joanne is joining us from Tipton. Hi, Joanne.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What do you make of this conversation? Are you involved in healthcare?
Yes, I have been for just about 20 years.
Mm-hmm. What point do you want to make or question do you have?
In the last 15 years, even though my background is public health, I got into direct care work through hospice. And the question I would like to ask about your excellent study is, have you considered levels lower in the organization under RNs? I worked for 5 years for Nurse Finders in Des Moines, and that's an agency. Nurse agencies provide temporary workers to the hospital, perhaps the University of Iowa not. But what I saw was that the people who get called the most frequently to the patient rooms in the hospitals are the nurse aides. And through agency, I worked all the major medical centers, as well as lots of nursing homes, and it's the nurse aides who are not as good at washing their hands. I found that the RNs were fantastic in the medical centers at washing their hands, but I can't tell you how many times I saw in the nursing homes on the night shift patient, CNAs would go into the rooms, do their checks, and not wash their hands. And a lot of those nursing home patients are going to the hospitals. So I think there are some elements of your study that could be expanded, and I think that the problem isn't the RNs. I think it's other levels of healthcare workers.
Okay. Let's get a reaction to that,
Doctor. In our particular study, we included everybody on the unit, regardless of job class, physicians, nurses, assistants, et cetera. And I think the point is good that we really don't know. I'll give you an example that sometimes we make assumptions about job roles in contact with patients. And a few years ago, certain hospitals around the country were deciding who should get vaccinated for influenza, and some of these hospitals were excluding clerks, patient clerks, because they were sitting at the front. But it turns out that when you actually study, and we've done some of these studies here at University of Iowa, they're very connected, and they don't necessarily have a classic healthcare role, but they're actually going up to patients, getting the signed documents, becoming, you know, very close, and sometimes, you know, assisting, and are much more connected perhaps than other healthcare workers. So it's really important, and I think the point is to get we need more data to drive policy. Okay. We really need to understand.
Maren, you wanted to get in on this.
Yeah, it was interesting that you brought up the nursing homes and the hospice areas as well, because these are places where you get a lot of transmission of the bacteria, and it's hard to figure out, you know, where we should put sinks, where we should put Purell bottles without, you know, not making it look like a home. You know, we want these nursing homes to be someone's home, but we also need to stop the spread of bacteria in these places. And so, you know, how do you make it so you're not spreading bacteria but still keeping the residents safe?
Okay. Joanne and Tipton, thank you for that excellent point, that question.
Thank you very much.
And let's go to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Our time is running short. Craig, you've got a question.
Yeah, I've always wondered about the rubber glove or the plastic glove dispensers, if they can become contaminated themselves.
Interesting, Craig. Let's get an answer to that, because when you mentioned, Maren, you mentioned, you know, your study of privacy curtains, that's one area that perhaps hadn't been considered enough, and certainly your study shows that it hadn't been considered enough. So what other areas? Rubber glove dispensers, they're all over, right?
Yeah, so I think people have swabbed those rubber glove dispensers and found bacteria on them. But we really encourage healthcare workers to wash their hands before putting the gloves on and to wash their hands again after taking the gloves off. And so if you think about it, you know, you're taking the gloves off, you could contaminate your own hand with what was on the glove. And so, you know, as long as you're washing your hands a lot throughout the whole process, it doesn't really matter if the glove dispenser itself is sterile.
Okay. Excellent question. Thank you, Craig in Cedar Rapids. I want to spend a few minutes in closing here talking about where this is all heading, because as you've said a number of times, there's this gap in knowledge. We can see that a lot of data, a lot more data is being collected now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. Technology is enabling us to do that. And then we have something called iScrub, and then that's linked up with a website, Jason?
Well, yeah. So it is an internal website to the hospital, and then it's just linked to a monitor within the unit where we did our original iScrub study. And the rates would be calculated and sort of statistics generated that would, one, both feed to a real-time display showing compliance rates, and then a sort of back-end tool that's sort of a managerial type of person who could go and see aggregate statistics mm-hmm. of how well a unit was doing over time and sort of take this long-term view of the unit under observation.
Where do each of you see this going in the future? It seems like it's progressed incredibly quickly just in the last 5 or 10 years. If we forecast it 10 years down the road, what will it look like?
Well, I think that data will increasingly drive decision-making in hospitals. And I think the importance will be to fuse data from different sources and to use this to understand how we can make hospitals a safer place. I think mm-hmm. that with the emergence of electronic medical records and such, there'll be a lot of opportunities to try to help make the hospitals safer.
Your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that really what we hopefully see is like Phil said, these sort of data-driven methods, but sort of factoring in more like simulation-based parts that a hospital would have this access to an immense level of, you know, computation, not necessarily Google size, but a way to be running constant real-time analysis on not only patient data, but the type of stuff that the movement of healthcare workers and the context amongst each other, the stuff that right now we don't have necessarily the best data on, but then start doing these sort of more sophisticated analysis every day in real time, and then have a mechanism to provide this information back to healthcare workers with the hope that improving healthcare overall.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, back to a very basic thing, we talked about hand washing the whole hour, and some people may be saying that hand washing, that's pretty simple. Hands, water, soap, rinse off the hands, towel off the hands, done deal. Not so.
Well, but time after time, studies show that healthcare workers aren't doing it as often as they should be. So we really have to do more than just put posters up and tell them to wash their hands.
But there is a correct way to wash hands, right?
Absolutely.
How do you do that if we were going to
So it takes a while. You know, you have to do your fingernails, the back of your hand, the front of your hand. But also, there are just so many times that healthcare workers have to wash their hands after they touch the curtains, after they touch a keyboard, after they touch their patient. And so really, there's the five moments of hand hygiene where there are five different times that you're supposed to wash your hands. But really, we say, wash your hands after you touch stuff. And that's the easier way to remember when people have to wash their hands.
Go ahead.
Oh, and we also just need to get our patients into this, too, and tell our patients, if you see someone not washing your hands, tell them, don't touch me until you use that Purell bottle.
So it wouldn't be out of bounds for me to go into my appointment. I see the doctor come into my examination room. I'm sitting there, and I see the doctor come in, and I don't see him wash his hands. I should actually say something?
I think so. In fact, you know, at the University Hospital, there have been pilot studies to give cards out and have patients actually score their healthcare providers and actually ask, you know, did they wash it, and encourage them to say something otherwise. I think that'll increasingly be more and more common.
This is your area of study, something you're very interested in. I wonder if this, in more of a personal question here, does this area of study make you a germaphobe? Maren?
It did at first, and then I realized as long as you're not picking your nose and things like that, you'll be fine in the end.
No, I think bacteria are on. They're it's impossible to get rid of them. You know, to live in a sterile world. And I think we just need to understand that and try to save the antibiotics that we have, so that when we need them, they'll work.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Philip Paul Green, of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Maren Schweitzer, and Jason Fries. It's been enlightening, and I will think about the hospital a different way the next time I walk through the door. Thank you, all three of you, very much.
Thanks.
And finally today, one of the University of Iowa's best-known professors died yesterday in Iowa City at the age of 89. Samuel L. Becker was the longtime chair of communication studies and served the University of Iowa in many other capacities. Becker was also instrumental in the development of public radio station WSUI, now a part of Iowa Public Radio. Iowa Public Radio staffer Dennis Reese was one of Becker's students way back in the 1970s, and he has these thoughts about the man everyone called Sam.
Sam Becker may have been the most important figure in the history of the University of Iowa in the last half of the 20th century. Born in Quincy, Illinois, he started his studies as a freshman in Iowa City in 1940. As the unofficial archivist at IPR's Iowa City stations, I have found wonderful black and white photos of Sam taking part in live drama productions at WSUI, standing tall with a script in his hand and a sound effects man in the background, wearing a tweed suit at age 19 in one of the grand old studios in the now-demolished 1939 radio addition to the engineering building. Sam was a devoted public radio listener and went on to be faculty advisor to WSUI in the 1950s. In 1977, I started as a graduate student in the UI's Department of Speech and Dramatic Art, now called Communication Studies. I didn't know Sam when I started my studies, but at that time all new grad students were required to take a one-credit-hour class. Some of it was just learning the MLA style book. But the highlight was a lecture from Professor Samuel L. Becker. On day one, Professor Bruce Gronbeck introduced Sam, and we waited a minute for the great man with a bow tie to enter the room. We sat spellbound. We knew we were in the presence of one of the top communication scholars of the century. But there was no pretension there. Sam had a sort of rustic look and a way of talking that was as straightforward and plain as an Iowa farmer. The takeaway for us new grad students? Do not forget to treasure our time with him. Funny thing about Sam, he always looked a lot younger than he was. When he retired at about 70 as chair of communication studies, the university just wouldn't let him fade away. And he served in a number of critical positions, such as acting provost, well into his 70s. Can it really be that he was 89 when he died yesterday? He didn't seem that old. He just gave up driving a couple of months ago. I hope he was proud each time he drove by the Samuel L. Becker Communication Studies building. I told him recently that I had located a copy of a book of his, an early book, a manual on the techniques of television production, copyright 1954. In his usual self-deprecating style, he said it wasn't that great of a book. But I know better. It was one of the earliest TV production books ever published, and I'm sure that people like Walter Cronkite must have read it. Sam, you will be missed. I'm just one of your thousands of former students who were influenced and changed by you. I can't even begin to imagine how many of your PhD students have gone on to be some of the world's leading teachers and scholars. I didn't become a scholar, just a public radio guy. But I'll never forget your 1977 lecture in Jessup Hall, room 402, telling us new grad students that it's really all about community and that whatever we learn should be shared. Get the footnotes right, but respect learning and strive to be a decent person. I'm Dennis Reese.
Thank you so much, Iowa Public Radio's Dennis Reese, with that remembrance of one of University of Iowa's best-known professors who died yesterday in Iowa City at the age of 89, Sam Becker. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. And River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.